Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to this Council on Foreign Relations conference call. I'm Irina Fascanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Thank you for joining us. As a reminder, today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website, cfr.org. We're delighted to have Edward Alden with us today to discuss the implications of President Obama's executive action on immigration. Mr. Alden is CFR's Bernard L. Schwartz Senior Fellow and the director of CFR's Renewing America publication series. Prior to joining CFR, he was the Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. Mr. Alden is the author of the book, The Closing of the American Border, Terrorism, Immigration, and Security Since 9/11, and co-author of the CFR report on managing illegal immigration to the United States. He is a frequent commentator and analysis on television and radio on both political and economic issues. Ted, thank you very much for being with us. It would be great if you could kick this off by giving us an overview of President Obama's recent executive action on immigration and what it means.
Great. Thank you very much, Irina, and thanks to everyone on the call. We have a CFR video series some of you might have seen called Three Things to Know, which you might check out on our website if you haven't already. I did one right after the president's announcement on the immigration action and its significance. And I'll follow the same format here, though, go into a bit more detail. That's kind of a very kind of brief hit on big issues. So I want to talk about kind of three big themes coming out of the president's executive action on immigration. So to start, this is clearly a big, bold action. I'm not a lawyer. Some of you on the call may be, but it's clearly reading through the justification. It's clearly based on a very expansive reading of the president's constitutional authority. No president has ever tried to stretch this authority in the immigration space quite as far as President Obama has. If you're interested in delving into the dueling arguments, it's worth reading the opinion of the Justice Department Office of Legal Counsel that was released when the president made this announcement. And there's an interesting rebuttal that's just appeared in the last couple of days by Jen Ting, who's a law professor at Temple University. And they're sort of a good juxtaposition for some of the legal arguments that I think are going to play out in the courts. So in a nutshell, if you look at the OLC justification for this action, it says quite accurately on my reading that federal immigration law gives the president broad discretion to defer deportation. Now, let's be clear on this. It's not legalizing. This is deferring deportation for individuals on a case-by-case basis. The Department of Homeland Security, its immigration enforcement agents, the courts do this every day for individuals for all sorts of reasons. It can be for humanitarian reasons, not wanting to deport someone and eliminate the breadwinner from the family. It could be due to simple resource constraints, that there is only the capacity to remove so many individuals living here illegally, and there's got to be some priority. You simply can't remove everybody. So this kind of discretion takes place all the time. Less commonly, however, administrations will defer actions for very broad groups of people. So, for instance, there's something that dates back to the 1990 immigration law passed by Congress called temporary protected status. And there are hundreds of thousands of people from El Salvador and Honduras who've been living in the United States for a long time under this temporary protected status. And it was a result of natural disasters in their home countries. If I'm remembering correctly, I think it was the earthquake in El Salvador in 2001 and Hurricane Mitch in Honduras. So the rationale is it's impossible for these people to return home. So even though they're not here in a lawful status, we're not going to deport them. Similar kind of action for foreign students who were affected by Hurricane Katrina. If you're here on a foreign student visa, you have to be in a full program of study. Well, as a result of Hurricane Katrina, a number of the universities were shut down. Students couldn't keep their proper immigration status. The administration said, well, we're not going to deport these people. We'll wait until the universities reopen and they can get back under status. And then there have been a couple of cases, particularly under the first President Bush, where you had deferral for a larger class, in that case spouses and children, of people who were made eligible for legalization by the 1986 Immigration Reform and Control Act. So this has been done in various ways in the past, but nothing quite this ambitious has ever been tried before. So what the administration is doing is granting deferral initially for a three-year period to a very large group of individuals. These are undocumented immigrants with children who are either U.S. citizens or lawful permanent residents and who have lived in the United States for at least 5 years. So starting next May, there's actually kind of a six-month window before this goes into effect. Starting next May, they can come forward to the government. They can show documents that prove that they meet the eligibility criteria. They have to pay a fee, $460 is what the administration has set, have to undergo background checks. And if they pass all of those hurdles, then they will be protected from removal for this three-year period, and they will also gain work authorization. So they'll be eligible to be employed legally in the United States. The administration has also expanded its 2012 deferral, which is commonly known as DACA, for those brought to the U.S. by their parents when they were minors. So they've expanded that, the age categories for that somewhat. All told, the estimates are that as many as 5 million people out of the total estimated unauthorized population of about 11.5 million people could be eligible for relief under the president's action. The legal justification for this is essentially twofold. So given limited resources, the argument goes, these people are highly unlikely to be deported anyway. The administration for some time has been focusing on people with criminal records, recent border crossers, other high priority individuals. And so these are not the people we're going after anyway. And so it makes sense to formalize their presence, know that they're here, allow them to work legally. The second argument is that Congress has long made a priority of unifying families, and that this is essentially an extension of that principle. Because many of these people have U.S. citizen children, they might eventually someday become eligible for legal status. And so basically the administration is saying, well, we're not going to break up families while that is pending. This is kind of an interim measure. I won't go into Jan Ting's rebuttal, but he makes one interesting point. He points out that if you're here on a temporary visa, say an H-1B visa, and you have a child, that child is, of course, a U.S. citizen because we in the United States have birthright citizenship. But if your visa runs out and you can't renew it, then you're going to have to leave the country, and you'll end up taking your U.S. citizen child with you. So he argues, we do believe in family unity, but it makes a difference whether it's in the U.S. or abroad. Anyway, to conclude on part one, it's pretty clear there's going to be some kind of court challenge to the president's action. I think president's legal advisors have come up with strong justification, but it's clear that this will, in one way or another, play its way out in the courts, either due to state challenges or perhaps challenges from immigration enforcement agents. Second thing to know, this action is not just all about undocumented immigrants. There are a number of other significant pieces in the president's action. Many of you in the states will be interested in the fate of a program known as Secure Communities, which was established under the Bush administration as a way to involve local law enforcement in identifying people who are in the country unlawfully. The administration has announced that it's going to eliminate the Secure Communities program and replace it with something called a Priority Enforcement Program. There are lots of bells and whistles under Secure Communities, but basically the way the program operates is that state and local police, when they book an individual on suspicion of some crime, the fingerprints from that individual go to the FBI, and the FBI then shares those fingerprints with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. If ICE checks its databases, has reason to believe the person whose fingerprints they received is here illegally, it will ask the local state police to hold that person under a detainer and then turn them over to ICE potentially for action and deportation. The program, as many of you know, has been highly controversial. Many urban police departments don't want to participate. They fear it's going to undermine the trust they have in immigrant communities. They don't want to be seen as an extension of federal immigration authorities. There have been cases where U.S. citizens have been wrongly detained, and there have been a number of court challenges that suggest that the actions of local police may not be constitutionally justified under this program. So the details of the new program that the administration has announced are still a bit scant, but it appears that the new scheme is basically going to work like this. So the administration has formalized a new three-tier set of priorities for deportation. And so basically what it's saying is these are the individuals that we want to focus on with our enforcement research. So priority number one is people who committed a felony, someone who's thought to be a national security threat, and recent border crossers who are apprehended right at the border when they're trying to enter illegally. That's category number one. The second category is those convicted of three or more misdemeanors or something called a significant misdemeanor, which can include drug trafficking or sexual assault or other crimes that even though technically they may be misdemeanors, we would all consider quite serious crimes. That would be the second category. And then the third priority will be those who were issued a removal order after January 1st of 2014. Quite interesting. I mean, implicit in that is that the administration is not planning to go after people who were issued removal orders earlier than 2014 and are still in the United States. They're often referred to as absconders. So they are not a priority for removal under this this new scheme. So basically, and as I say, the details aren't all out yet, but as I understand it, how that's going to work is if someone is arrested by state and local police now, the fingerprints are still going to go to the FBI and they're going to go to ICE, but ICE will only ask that that individual be held if they fit into one of these priority categories for deportation. So there's not going to be the kind of routine holding of people based on a simple ICE suspicion that they might be here illegally. There's going to be a higher standard. So I'll be interested to see how this plays out in practice, but this is the basics of what they've announced. Quickly on the legal immigration portions of the action, a number of companies that use high-skilled immigrant workers had hoped for something bolder, had hoped for an effective increase in high-skilled immigration by capturing, I can get into it if people want, by capturing some of the old visa numbers that have been unused. The administration did not do that, but it did a number of things that will make life a little better for high-skilled immigrants in the United States. There will be, and this has been announced previously, work authorization for the spouses of H-1B holders. So historically, if you were the spouse of an H-1B here in the United States, you couldn't work unless you had some other independent legal status in the U.S. That is going to be changed so that spouses of many H-1B visa holders can work. There's going to be expansion of a program called Optional Practical Training, which allows foreign students to stay in the United States for up to about 2.5 years and work after they graduate without being on any other visa category. Administration says it's going to use special waiver powers that it has under the law to permit foreign entrepreneurs, inventors, researchers to come or to stay in the United States after they graduate from school. We don't have in the United States right now an entrepreneur's visa. The Canadians have this, other countries have that. So this is sort of using executive power to try to create the equivalent of a visa for foreign entrepreneurs. And then finally, the administration is going to make it easier for temporary visa holders who have green card applications pending to switch jobs. For a lot of H-1B visa holders, life is very difficult because if you're an Indian in the United States on an H-1B and your employer has sponsored you for a green card, you may end up waiting 6, 8, 10 years for that green card. And under current rules, it's really hard for you to change jobs. You basically have to stay in the same job in the same category until you get your green card. Administration says it's going to make it easier to move up, say, to a manager position or to actually go to an entire another company and not have to start over again. So those are really, in broad brush strokes, the details of what the president has done in this action. So it leads me to my third and concluding point, which is, how is the new Republican Congress going to react to this? Because a great deal will depend on how this is received by the Republicans, who, of course, will take control of the Senate as well as the House in 2015. You know, the context of all this, of course, as you know, the reason the president has done this is the failure of the Congress to pass comprehensive immigration reform legislation, a failure that now stretches all the way back to the early parts of the second term of the George Bush administration. So we've been at this pretty much for 10 years now. The Senate has been able to find a compromise, but the Republicans are divided, and particularly in the House, and the leadership has not been willing to risk the wrath of opponents within the party by trying to move a comprehensive bill. So in the near term, as some of you I'm sure are reading in the news, it's pretty clear that the Republicans are going to fight this measure, but it seems unlikely that they will resort to the only real weapon they have, which is to cut off funding and force a government shutdown Speaker Boehner in the House is supporting a motion that's effectively a censure of the president. It looks like they're going to pass a piece of legislation that would override the president, but of course it won't make it through the Senate, and Obama wouldn't even have to veto it. So it really is a symbolic action. On spending, it looks like the Congress is going to pass, you know, as always, the Congress is way behind in passing its spending bill. It's going to pass a year-long spending bill, which takes us up through September, except for the Department of Homeland Security, which has to implement this new action. And it looks like they're going to offer the DHS maybe a 2 or 3 month funding window so that the Republicans can revisit this early in the new year. It's not clear that this is a very effective stick for the Republicans. The department says that the new program for enrolling undocumented is entirely fee-funded, so that the expenses of that program are going to be covered entirely by the $460 that each applicant is going to have to pay. If that's the case, it's not clear that actually Congress has the power of the purse to shut down this program simply by trying to cut off the funding. There are some in the party, Senator Jeff Flake has been prominent among them, who are arguing that this action actually opens a legislative window now for the Republicans. The Republican Party has long said that it doesn't want comprehensive reform. What it favors is piecemeal reform, tackling each part of a big problem in separate legislative chunks. In the past, that was always blocked by the Democrats, because the Democrats feared, well, okay, if you do border security, you do interior enforcement, the one piece that won't get done is some kind of legalization for the undocumented. Flake makes the case that now, in the wake of this action, it might be possible for the Republicans to pass a border security bill, to pass an interior enforcement bill, to pass a high-skilled immigration bill, which is very popular, get it on the president's desk, and the president may well be reluctant to veto that sort of legislation. Flake thinks it might even be possible to pass a bill that holds out the carrot of full legalization for the undocumented, but subject to hitting some enforcement benchmarks. And that's long been part of the discussion, but the Democrats have resisted it. So in closing, I wouldn't say any of this is terribly likely. I wouldn't bet on significant legislative action, especially given the very intense distrust that has developed between the president and the House Republicans. But with the 2016 elections, it seems like we're always saying elections are looming. So the 2016 elections are now looming now that we finished the 2014 election. There are many in the Republican Party who believe they need some kind of positive agenda on immigration to take into the next campaign. So perhaps that will be enough to shake the party a bit loose. So let me stop there. I've been a little over time, but happy to take questions.
Ted, that was a great overview, walking us through the legislation and what it means. As you know, we have both religious leaders and state and local officials on the call today. I'm sure that many of you are working closely on this issue in your communities. So we look forward to hearing your experiences and insights and whatever questions and comments you might have for Ted. So, Noelle, let's open it up to the group.
Thank you. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, just press star 2. Please limit your questions to one at a time. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1. We are currently holding for questions. Our first question comes from Thomas Walsh with Universal Peace Federation. Great.
Thank you very much for this presentation. Just to jump in, I hope this isn't too far afield. I know this isn't the focus of your presentation or even the focus of the discussion, but there are underlying, let's call them moral considerations that drive this argument, whether to assist or not to assist in this case. And you know, there are these discussions that go on, both in philosophical discussions and in religious discussions, of the kind of moral responsibilities of states toward burdened peoples of other less prosperous states. It often is discussed in areas of distributive redistribution of wealth, so to speak, or how to equalize wealth between the prosperous and the non-prosperous, and some argue for very strong theory of obligations to the needy and others that see states. I think of John Rawls thinking more of the responsibilities of states and their political culture needs to be preserved, and that the realm of justice is kind of limited to the state to some extent. Anyway, if this is not a topic that's of interest to you or to others, it's either, but I just wanted to throw it out. It's what came to mind to me. Thank you.
It's a good point, and this action, and I'm, you know, I don't have any monopoly on this by any stretch, but this action raises all sorts of very, very interesting moral questions, because there are a lot of distinctions that have been made that at some level I suppose are kind of arbitrary. You know, I look at the question, for instance, of who's eligible. So, you know, if you happen to have been living here out of status for at least 5 years and you're present, you have U.S. citizen children, you're eligible. If you're present and you don't have U.S. citizen children, so these could even be children who qualified for deferral under the DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival, you're not eligible because you don't have a blood relative in the United States. So it's just the accident. Perhaps you brought your kids over when they were, you know, 5 and 8 and 12 and you didn't have other kids in the United States, so you don't have U.S. citizen children. Someone else who did have children in the United States qualifies. If you're someone who was deported, even deported a month ago, and may otherwise, if you hadn't been deported, you've managed somehow to stay in the United States, you'd be eligible for this. The fact that you've been deported, you're not only out of the country, if you try to get back in, you are a priority for capture and removal. You're in that category one. So again, a rather arbitrary kind of distinction. You know, the distributive justice questions you raise are debated a lot in this. If you look at people like Lance Pritchett at the Center for Global Development, made a very strong argument that the best thing that you can do for people from poorer parts of the world is to open up immigration, because it increases their living standards dramatically when they move from a poorer country to a richer country. But opponents make an argument saying, well, look, we got a situation in the United States where we have still fairly high unemployment or underemployment levels, and suddenly we're giving formal work authorization to as many as 5 million people. Isn't that new competition for some of our poorer citizens? So there are enormous moral discussions that get thrown up by this, and I think they will continue for a long time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Bruce Noss with Unitarian Universalist Association.
Yes, my question, I guess I'm asking if you can look in your crystal ball a bit. I mean, our faith, and I think many faith-based organizations, are quite appalled at the human rights dimensions of our current immigration policy. And, you know, families that are torn apart, people that are deported, that have lived here and worked for years and years and years, that you know, really should be allowed to stay. Is there, what can civil society do, and is there a chance of getting a sane and sensible immigration policy which recognizes the human rights dimension, also recognizes the important role that immigrants play in our economy? I mean, if we had a magic wand and could disappear all the undocumented immigrants in this country tomorrow, we all know our economy would suffer greatly. There are a lot of jobs that just would not get done. So it's not only a moral issue, but it's an economic issue that we really have to come up with a much better, more humane, more rational policy than what we have. Is there any chance of this happening? And what should a civil society be doing to push us in that direction?
Good question. I'm getting very big questions, which I appreciate. On the civil society part, let me start with the immediate and then try to look out a little farther. There are going to be huge challenges in terms of implementation of this policy, and that's in particular informing people of their eligibility for the program and then helping them navigate the bureaucracy in a way that makes it possible for them to gain eligibility. I mean, typically in these things, you know, we talk about 5 million, If you look at the DACA action, the prediction at the time was 1.5 million people roughly would come forward. Only half that many have come forward under the program. And this is the younger, English-speaking, raised in America portion of the population that's probably quite a bit more comfortable dealing with government agencies than their parents would be. So there's going to be a lot of work to be done just helping people understand what's in this action, are they eligible, what kind of documents are they going to need, helping them navigate a very complicated and difficult federal bureaucracy. In terms of the broader change, the president's been pretty clear on this. You know, any kind of more lasting reform requires legislation. You can't tackle the big things here without doing legislation. And so I think, you know, the push for some kind of congressional action, I think, remains very much a priority. My hope is that this might actually shake some things loose and make legislative action more likely. There are other people who believe, you know, as the speaker has put it, that this has so poisoned the well between the White House and the Congress that no action is possible. And then just finally, even if we get immigration reform, I don't think you're ever going to develop an immigration policy that satisfies everyone as being somehow just and humanitarian. There are just too many competing equities here. No advanced country completely opens itself up to immigration. And if you don't, then you're always making distinctions on who you want to let in, either for your own needs, economic needs, or for broader political or humanitarian reasons. There's always going to be a difficult selection process, and I think it will always be subject to criticism. I think we can do a lot better than we're doing right now, but no country has devised the perfect sort of system for enforcing this kind of quota.
Great. Next question.
Thank you again. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. Our next question comes from Rebecca Jaramillo with the Democratic Latino Organization of Virginia.
Hi, that's Rebecca Jaramillo. Hello?
Hello.
Great. Yes, please,
hi.
Go ahead.
No, that's fine. I'm a little bit curious, and perhaps I'm wrong, because I used to do consular work overseas, and a lot of these people will be or would be eligible at some point in their American citizen children's lives under first preference to become legally eligible to be in the United States. It's only a matter of time. And I never hear that mentioned. I know that there are different rules, and it wouldn't be until the children were older and they'd have to have, you know, certificates of support and affidavits of support and all this sort of thing. But essentially, aren't we just kind of, I mean, a lot of these people would be eligible to live here anyway, so a certain percentage of them. So I don't understand why that isn't talked about and why we don't just deal with the fact that we're just sort of, you know, giving them advance legal residency, and we're not really, they may be jumping the queue a little bit, but we're not necessarily doing something that is, you know, completely, something that is completely displacing other potential immigrants and this sort of thing. Or have things changed so much since I was working in consular offices?
No. I actually think that's a very good question. And if you read the Justice Department opinion from the Office of Legal Counsel, that argument is in fact central to the claim that the president is justified in taking this action. So they lay out exactly of family unification, that many of these people will eventually have a legal path through their children, and therefore this action is in effect what you're talking about. It's not breaking up families in the interim while we're waiting for the legal process to play out.
Has the media just ignored this?
Well, I admit I have not seen it reported on very much, and it, which is interesting because it's very prominent in the OLC opinion. I mean, there are two potential counters to this. One is that it depends, and not to get down in the weeds too much, but it depends, that scenario depends on people being waived under the 1996 law known as IRA, which essentially says if you've been unlawfully present in the United States for more than a year and you return home, you are statutorily barred from returning to the United States for periods of between 3, 5, and 10 years.
Those are generally waived for, like, parents, especially elderly parents, aren't they?
they're absolutely, the administration could waive them, so, and you could waive them for whole classes. That was one of the things that the Senate immigration bill talked about doing. So that's a legal hurdle, but it could be overcome. The other has to do with how this plays out politically on the other side, because, you know, I'm sure you and others have heard the argument about anchor babies. You know, people are coming to have children in the United States so that they will eventually be eligible for citizenship. I often knock down this argument by saying, well, look, you know, the waiting periods are so long, right? You got to wait until your child turns 21, and then you're going to have another long waiting period because of the quotas. You know, people aren't coming to the United States to do that. That's just silly. But this argument, I think, in a strange way, kind of engages that discussion again of birthright citizenship in the United States and what the implications of it are. But it's very much there in the OLC opinion, and if this goes to court, I think it's going to be an important part of the case that the administration makes, because, you know, the administration is going to have to argue that what it did here was not totally at odds with congressional intent. And the family unification argument is a big piece of making that case to the courts. Good question.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Gregory Hamilton with Northwest Religious Liberty Association.
Yeah, hi there. Thanks for joining us. I deal with a lot of immigrants who are immigrant workers, and having Title VII religious discrimination issues in the workplace, especially in fruit plants and so forth. But my question to you is mainly about the politicization of the word amnesty, which seems to be used by the right quite a bit. To make their point. Could you elaborate on that and how it's either working or not working, and maybe give us a forecast of how that language is being used successfully or not successfully?
Yeah, thank you. Also, a really good question. I'm not sure I've got a comprehensive answer. If you go back to 1986, the Immigration Reform and Control Act that was passed by the Congress, signed by President Reagan, which at the time offered a path to citizenship for just under 3 million undocumented immigrants in the United States, it was called an amnesty. I mean, everybody, supporters and opponents, referred to it as an amnesty. It was not a pejorative in the way it became subsequently. I haven't really seen a good study, and there's probably a good dissertation in there somewhere, of how the word sort of came to be appropriated by the opponents of another legalization and used as a pejorative. I mean, one of the arguments you hear, and you heard it yesterday when Secretary Johnson was in front of the House Homeland Security Committee, is this claim that if you do an amnesty, it's kind of a magnet for more to come. So people will come thinking that, well, you know, 10, 15, 20 years down the road, there will be another amnesty, and I will be allowed to stay. All of the research I have seen suggests that there's no amnesty effect, that people aren't being attracted to come to the United States illegally by the hope of at some point being legalized. But it's a very strong argument made by opponents of immigration reform. We heard it yesterday on the Hill. We'll hear it many times again. I suppose the other way in which it is used is sort of the sense of fairness, that, you know, because our legal immigration system works so poorly, people wait very, very long periods of time in order to be able to migrate legally. And there are arguments, and I think they've got some legitimacy made, that, well, why should we reward people who didn't follow the rules, people who came here illegally, and now somehow are receiving a benefit that's denied to people who played through the legal channel. So that's the two ways in which I hear the word used, but I'm sure there's a lot more to the story than that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question or comment.
Thank you again. If you would like to ask a question or have a comment for our speakers, please press star 1. Our next question comes from Roger Ross with New Vision Inner Spirituality Seminary.
Thank you very much for having me. I just have an off-the-wall observation about why conservatives might be so desperately against this, and I'm just wondering what the effect of anywhere from a million to 500 to 5 million people suddenly coming into this country who can vote once they've established themselves. And how much does it seem that the conservative branch that is fighting so hard against this might be looking at the fact that the majority of those votes would not go to conservative but to more liberal platforms?
Again, excellent question. I think, you know, in the debate in Congress over the last decade, that has been a significant factor. And I think was very much a part of Republican opposition to what's called the path to citizenship, that eventually these people will become U.S. citizens and be eligible to vote. I mean, just a historical footnote, that's less common than you might think. You know, the 86 law provided the path to citizenship, but only about a third of those who were given legal status actually eventually became U.S. citizens. Most didn't do that either because of the expense of applying for citizenship or other reasons. But I think that was a big factor in the debates up on the Hill. I don't think that's a big factor in what's going on now for two reasons. One, at the beginning of this year, when it looked like the House Republicans might be prepared to move, Speaker Boehner floated the idea of legalization but no citizenship, precisely to try to deal with this opposition from within his own party. I think a lot of people had expected the Democrats to say, no, this is outrageous, we'll be creating second-class citizens, even though that's a bit of an oxymoron, but we'll get second-class individuals in the United States, this is just wrong. Well, in fact, you know, Luis Gutierrez, who's been the leader for the Democrats in the House, said, well, I don't like that proposal. I think people should have a chance to move towards citizenship, but I can live with it because the priority is to stop the threat of deportation, allow them and their families to live normal lives in the United States. So in a way, the citizenship stuff was kind of shunted to the side, even when there was possibly legislation. Now, of course, this action is much more limited still. This is a temporary 3-year deferral from deportation. Could be undone by this president or a future president at any point. Doesn't provide them with permanent status, certainly doesn't provide a path to citizenship. So I think the opposition to this particular measure has nothing to do with that fear, even though that has definitely been in the mix in discussions on immigration reform for a long time now.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your clarity.
Ted, if you could draw it up, and the Republican-Democratic stance were put aside, what would you say would be the ideal immigration legislation that should fit forward to encourage and foster U.S. competitiveness?
In 25 words or less.
Yeah, 25 words or less, right. How's that?
I actually, you know, it would take people a long time to go through, but I actually thought the Senate bill was pretty good. The Senate bill did a lot of sensible things, particularly in terms of making it easier for foreign students in the United States to stay here and work and become permanent residents. And I think that's our real advantage. The United States has the best universities in the world. You see these surveys of, you know, 100 top global universities, and you know, 73 of them are in the United States. Last year, more than 800,000 foreign students were studying in the United States. And these are very often the best and the brightest from the countries who are sending them. So I think the real key to a successful immigration policy from economic competitiveness perspective is to make it relatively easy for these people to remain in the United States if they wish to. And our current policy doesn't do that. The Senate bill had a lot of provisions that would have made it much easier for foreign students to remain, included as an entrepreneur's visa if you want to stay here and start up a new company. Currently, there's no way to do this legally. You know, if you're a foreign grad student from China and you want to start a company in the United States, there's no legal way under the current immigration system to do that. So the Senate bill had a lot of provisions dealing with that. So I really think that is the key. And interestingly, on this one, there's a big consensus. You could get 400 votes in the House of Representatives next week for a bill that made it easier for high-skilled folks to come and stay in the United States. There are pockets of opposition, but really overwhelming bipartisan support.
And in terms of what more faith leaders and local officials can do to encourage, you know, to push forward, advocate for a more comprehensive immigration reform, are there any levers?
I honestly don't know, because the faith community has been incredibly active in this, has by and large united behind comprehensive immigration reform, And they're not alone. I mean, the business community is strongly in favor. The labor unions, the AFL-CIO, historically was rather reluctant, but now it's come around to be a strong supporter of immigration reform. Farmers, obviously, very much in favor of it. Local police departments, because, you know, they'd rather deal with real crime than with immigration violations. So you do have this very broad coalition that's been pushing very strongly, but it just hasn't been enough to create some kind of breakthrough in the Congress. I think, for better or worse, the issue remains hostage to the internal politics of the Republican Party, with many members, you know, elected from districts with rather small immigrant populations, and who just aren't being pushed at all by their local constituents to move on this issue. In fact, they're being pushed in the opposite way, and a party leadership that I think really does want to move. But that division remains, and I really don't have a crystal ball on how that one turns out.
Great. Any other questions? I think that somebody noted that Ted is so comprehensive that he basically covered everything, but I will just throw it out there. If anybody else has a question or a comment or experience you want to share, we would be happy to hear that.
If there are any state and local officials who are willing to call in, I'd just be interested in hearing what this might mean for the states, because I think often a lot of this stuff gets passed down to the states in terms of trying to identify people who enroll, help them out in different ways, decide whether these individuals are going to be eligible for state-level benefits of different sorts. I think I understand the federal situation pretty clearly, but I do not understand the state situation. So if anybody had an observation on that, I think that would be very interesting.
We do have a question from Satpal Singh with State University of New York at Buffalo.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. In terms of economic impact of immigration, not only illegal but also legal immigration, there are often studies and claims that immigrants pose a competition to foreign citizens and also draw resources. Are there any rigorous studies that not only look at this impact, the negative impact, but also the positive contribution that immigrants make to the society, and comparing positive contributions with respect to drawing resources and so on? Are there any rigorous studies on that?
There have been a whole series of studies on exactly this question, from Congressional Research Service to all sorts of academics to others who have tried to look into it. The consensus seems to be that when you look at the totality of immigration to the United States, there's a small positive net benefit economically. So the added value that immigrants bring in terms of coming and working and earning paychecks and paying taxes slightly exceeds what they take out of the system in terms of education, health care, other benefits. I mean, it's not an enormous surplus, but it's a small one. What's very hard for these studies to get at is some of the intangible impacts, particularly at the high skilled end. You know, how much difference does it make that we've got Sergey Brin, who, you know, at Russian parents, came to the United States, found Google, right? And we know from studies out in Silicon Valley that about 40% of Silicon Valley companies had an immigrant founder or co-founder. So there's an awful lot of value brought by those people, but difficult to quantify. In the argument over sort of cost to government programs, one of the challenges here is that the costs and benefits are badly distributed in the sense that states, it's often a net negative to have a lot of low-skilled immigrants or undocumented immigrants, because of healthcare-related costs through Medicaid and other programs, because of the education costs. I mean, every child's entitled to be educated in the public schools. And the added payments tend to go to the federal government. You have a lot of undocumented immigrants working under false Social Security numbers, and they end up actually paying into the Social Security system. There's billions of dollars in surplus in the Social Security system from undocumented people who weren't paid into the system are never going to collect out. So the federal government's actually making money, and it's costing the states money. So this creates a lot of tension. It's a big question, a lot of research, and honestly, you won't get the two sides to agree on the validity of the research. Each kind of side has its favorite researchers. The the proponents like to look to people like David Card at Berkeley or Giovanni Perry at University of California, Davis. The opponents look to George Borjas at Harvard. So there, you know, there are wars going on between the economists over this.
Next question or comment? Thank you. If you would like to ask a question or have a comment, again, please press star 1. Our next question comes from Bruce Knotts with Unitarian Universalist Association.
And thank you for allowing me a couple of bites at the apple here. We've done some work with LGBT asylum seekers and refugees. We also have looked at the issue of climate change refugees. And we've looked at the model that was provided by Jewish immigration from the old Soviet Union in the 90s, where Congress passed a blanket authorization. So if you could demonstrate you were in that class of people, if you were a Soviet Jew, you did not have to individually adjudicate your case before an immigration judge to get asylum in the United States. It seems to me that these kinds of blanket authorizations should be used more often. It certainly would relieve the burden on immigration judges and the whole legal system if you could say, if you're part of this class, then you get your asylum. And I raised the issue of climate change because it's coming, and there are many nations which are losing their territory due to rising sea levels. Some small island states may disappear entirely, and yet there's nothing in either U.S. law or international law which would give them immigration status, and yet they're going to need to go someplace. And so I'm wondering if our immigration law can be made flexible enough to take care of classes of people needing that kind of help.
I think you've largely stumped me on that one, because I don't actually know how often this is used under the asylum law. But I did say there is this category of temporary protected status. So, you know, people who are already here in the United States, whether legally or illegally, from countries facing natural disaster of one sort or another. There have been a number of cases, it's not only natural, that can be political disasters, civil wars, other things. There have been a number of cases in which administrations have used that power, but I'm not as familiar with its use under asylum law, so I apologize. I don't really have a good sense of what the limitations are to that authority. I mean, generally speaking, administrations have very broad discretion under U.S. immigration laws, and this action will clearly be a test of just how broad. I think if this holds up in the courts, I think there are clearly many other things that future administrations could do to offer benefits to particular classes of individuals who are considered to be deserving in one way.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Bruce. Ted, you are running the Renewing America Initiative. It might be good for this group, since we are trying to serve as a resource, for you to talk a little bit about the Renewing America Initiative, the blog, and the scorecards that you produce, and how they may be useful in the work that our colleagues on the phone are doing.
Thanks very much, Rena. Yeah, this is a somewhat different area than the immigration work I'm doing, which obviously encompasses competitiveness issues, but lots of other issues as well. So the Renewing America program, in a nutshell, is an effort by CFR to look at really domestic sources of American power and foreign policy success in the world. Our director, Richard Haass, published a book about a year and a half ago now called Foreign Policy Begins at Home, making the argument that a lot of our biggest challenges right now as a country are domestic ones, and that strengthening our own economy is vital to the United States continuing to play a constructive international role in the future. So we have a small program here that I head that looks at a variety of issues that really are central to domestic economic renewal, and we've been publishing a series of overview papers that include an infographic, which you can get everything in a snapshot if you don't want to read the whole paper, looking at a number of these issues. So we've done them so far on infrastructure, on K-12 education, on trade and investment policy, which is another area I specialize in, on corporate tax reform, which is very much on the agenda in the new Congress. We've got a new one coming out very soon on worker retraining programs, helping people who've lost their jobs find a way back into the job market. So this is on our website, CFR.org, under the Renewing America program. So if you're interested, I encourage you to check them out. I think they can be a useful resource in explaining in fairly simple language and graphics as well some of these issues.
Thank you. And for final thoughts on immigration, you said it's been 10 years. Are you hopeful, or will it be another 10 years?
I honestly don't know. In a strange way, I am hopeful because I think it was clear that the approach that's been taken over the last decade had run out of steam. There was really an effort to sort of gradually address all of the concerns that opponents in the Congress had about immigration reform, and it seemed to get quite close. I was very optimistic in January of this year, following some of Speaker Boehner's comments, that we really were on the cusp of a breakthrough. But as is often the case with these, the last mile is the hardest, and that just didn't happen. And I think you can't go back to that drawing board. So I think at least the president's executive action has really shaken the trees a lot and created a very different situation on the ground that the politicians are now going to have to respond to. So I am at least slightly optimistic that the Republicans going into 2016 will want to have a positive immigration agenda and therefore will try to push some sort of legislation. Remains to be seen, but it'll be an interesting couple of years.
Great. Well, Ted Alden, thank you very much for your insights with us today. As I'm sure all of you will agree, Ted is the leading expert on immigration and other issues. I hope you will continue to follow him. He has a Twitter handle, at Edward Alden, as well as tweeting at Renewing America that covers some of the issues that he talked about, infrastructure and U.S. competitiveness. So I hope that you will all turn to those resources. And if you have other questions or comments or suggestions for topics and issues that we should be covering in this series, please email outreach@cfr.org, and we look forward to our next call. So again, thank you, Ted Alden.
Thanks very much, Ruth.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.